Okay, so picture this scene. You're in a warm, buzzing Italian restaurant. You can smell the garlic, the wine. It's lively, good conversation.
Sounds nice, like a regular night out.
Exactly. But somehow the talk turns to, well, global catastrophe, maybe even a pandemic. This is weeks before everything changes.
Ah, okay. I see where this is going. That chilling hindsight.
Right. The dramatic irony is just, wow, looking back, knowing what came just after, it's really potent, almost kind of haunting.
It really is. And it's fascinating how a totally normal setting like that dinner can suddenly become so loaded with meaning later on. That specific scene, it's like the perfect lens for the source material we're digging into today.
Absolutely. That dinner, that specific conversation, it's our way into some incredibly rich and honestly, sometimes pretty perplexing source material.
And we should clarify what we're working with here.
Good point. We're focusing on concepts from one chapter, the Cassandran Canticle. It's part of a larger collection called Anthology by David Noel Lynch.
And let's be super clear, this is not the famous movie director David Keith Lynch. Different person entirely.
Right. And interestingly, the text itself says this specific chapter was actually written by Gemini 2.5 Pro, but based on an outline from this David Noel Lynch.
Which makes the source material itself kind of unique. It's not just a story. It reads more like a really deep personal exploration, almost like someone mapping out their own understanding of events.
Yeah, it dissects thinking processes, looks hard at that specific dinner conversation, and then connects these abstract ideas to, well, the brutal reality that followed.
And all that leads into these bigger reflections on, fractured realities, why society seems so divided, and why those divisions just stick around.
So our mission today is basically to unpack all of that. We want to explore the different ways of thinking around that table, understand the, frankly, surprising foresight that popped up in that conversation.
See how events then tragically unfolded, almost mirroring some of those ideas.
And then really grapple with the core puzzle the source presents. Why isn't intelligence enough? Why doesn't smart thinking seem to bridge these huge ideological gaps we see everywhere?
It's about pulling out those key insights, those surprising facts hidden in what's quite a complex piece of writing.
Okay, let's really set that scene then. The mad Italian dinner. The source paints a picture warm, friendly, but also maybe a little intense. It mentions feeling like a place ripe for divination.
Right, like sensing something deeper bubbling under the surface, even amidst all the normal restaurant stuff, the garlic, the wine, simmering sauces, it gives it a specific weight.
Definitely not just a random meal. It feels like a stage. And who are the players? The text focuses on the author, who's described using personality frameworks as an INTJA.
And B.K. Sabat, identified as an ENTJA. Plus others mentioned, like Charles and Donna, were there too.
And the source really dives into the different cognitive styles it sees at play. That's pretty crucial to understanding their interaction.
It is. For the author, the INTJA, the source uses some vivid language. It talks about introverted intuition, ni, as this silent internal alembic, like a quiet furnace inside, kerning perceptions into these prescient insights, seeing connections, future paths. Inexorable horizons, it says.
Wow. Okay. And that's paired with what?
With extroverted thinking, T, described as this rigorous, almost mercilessly demanding force pushing for logical consistency, for things to make systemic sense. So it's deep internal processing before anything gets projected outward.
Okay. So that's one style. How does BK Sabay, the ENTJA, contrast?
The main contrast highlighted is the energy source. Extroversion drawing energy from interaction, thinking out loud, engaging the world directly. But, and this is important, they share that NTJ core.
Ah, so the underlying architecture for strategic systems thinking is similar.
Exactly. They might process differently, one inward, one outward, but they both approach things with that strategic mindset, navigating the world, the conversation, with a certain kind of gravitas.
And the source points out the significance of that single letter difference, the I versus the E, introvert versus extrovert, a fundamental orientation split.
Right. But then there's that strong three-letter congruence, NTJ, that shared foundation for analysis and intuition.
And they both have the assertive trait, the A.
Yes, which the source calls this adamantine self-trust, like a really strong internal anchor, giving them both unwavering conviction in their own conclusions.
Which sounds good, but the source points out a paradox, right?
It does. That shared assertiveness, that strong self-belief, can actually lead to deeper entrenchment when their views differ. Because they both trust their own internal processes so strongly, they're less likely to budge. even when they arrive at opposite conclusions.
Fascinating. And all this is happening against the backdrop of that feeling the source calls before the deluge.
Yeah, looking back, there's this sense of exquisite poignancy, that stark, inescapable, dramatic irony. Little things, casual remarks at the dinner, now seem unimaginably precious.
Because their fleeting nature wasn't recognized until, well, until what came after. The ordinary suddenly looks like this lost paradise, an Arcadian realm of lost, irretrievable certainties.
It's that feeling of standing on the edge of a cliff and having absolutely no idea, just enjoying the view.
And the source suggests maybe it wasn't such a sudden drop-off, that there was already a kind of hum beneath the surface, a low thrum of change.
Exactly. Not a conscious prediction then, but maybe an intuitive, almost visceral inkling of profound disquiet. It compares it to the atmospheric pressure changing before a huge storm, a sort of psychic barometer picking up unseen disturbances.
So that subtle unease, the source thinks, might have subconsciously steered the conversation towards bigger systemic crises.
Plausibly, yeah. Not just pulling ideas out of thin air, but maybe from this profound internal place where intuition was sensing these ominous vibrations.
Like the veneer of normalcy was thinner than anyone realized.
Perhaps. And that intuitive sense of instability might have primed the author's mind, at least, to think about large-scale disruption scenarios.
Which leads us to diagnosing society. The conversation, probably inevitably for the time, touched on the political climate. The source talks about the political palimpsest of the Trump presidency.
Yeah, casting a shadow, becoming this deeper cultural palimpsest, layers of loyalty, disillusionment, rupture. Just mentioning his name or related topics apparently acted like a volatile catalyst.
Exposing deep cracks, seismic fissures in society.
And the source describes the support base, the Trumplican base, it calls it, as something of an enigma, characterized by this unshakable, almost cultic devotion, seemingly resistant to facts or traditional reason.
That loyalty, it suggests, comes from a mix of anxieties, grievances, deep distrust.
Right, alongside a perception of eroding political norms and an assault on shared factual reality. Trump himself becoming this potent, almost totemic symbol for a nation grappling with change.
Which then prompts the author's big statement at the dinner, what the source calls a quiet yet chillingly resonant proclamation.
That they were living in a post-truth society.
And the source presents this not just as an opinion, but like a clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, a pervasive, insidious epistemological sickness. And it lists the symptoms. Rampant misinformation, hardened partisan echo chambers, eroding public trust, dismissing evidence for stories that just feel better.
So in this post-truth world, objective fact gets pushed aside, devalued by narratives that resonate emotionally, by tribal loyalty.
That's the argument. Critical thinking gets bypassed for stuff that's viscerally satisfying. The source insists this is a crisis in how we believe, how we validate information, not just what we believe.
And for the INTJ mind described in the source, this isn't just noise. It's seen as a coherent, dangerous pattern.
Exactly. Post-truth becomes shorthand for a really perilous shift in our relationship with reality itself. A disorienting hall of mirrors, the source calls it.
And this critique then extends to the media, using that really striking metaphor.
Punditry is mycelial network. Yeah, it's unsettling. Pundits aren't just seen as objective commentators, but as potentially insidious, paid agents pushing corporate or political agendas.
Like an underground fungus network, spreading ideas beneath the surface.
That's the image. A vast subterranean network spreading ideological spores, disguised as normal news or analysis, the legitimate factual flora. Narratives crafted and pushed for hidden masters, unstated and frequently rapacious masters.
Which definitely reflects that INTJ drive, the source, talks about digging beneath the surface, tracing the wiring, looking for hidden motives.
Right. You have to scrutinize the factual flora. Does it grow from objective inquiry or from those poisoned aquifers of power and partisanship?
So the media landscape, in this view, becomes like a managed farm. An ideological plantation.
Where certain stories are cultivated, others suppressed. Pundits are the diligent gardeners of this managed reality.
And that naturally leads to deep skepticism towards established information sources, right? Seeing them as active players in shaping reality, not just reporting it.
Absolutely. Which sets the stage for a really pivotal moment in the dinner conversation. The source calls it the oracular spark.
Okay, what happened?
Out of this analysis of a fragmented post-truth world, the author puts forward this potent, unsettling hypothesis. The idea of unity forged in fire.
Meaning?
The concept that maybe only a sufficiently overwhelming, universally shared existential threat could actually force humanity to come together.
Wow, that's bleak. But the source says it wasn't optimistic.
No, not naive hope. More like a detached, coldly analytical, game-theoretical assessment of what it might take for us to survive collectively. The idea that a massive crisis could override all our usual squabbles.
Like shared terror-forcing cooperation, where things like tribalism, ideology, nationalism just crumble because we're all facing the same abyss.
That's the concept. The crisis is a theoretical reset mechanism.
And this reflects that INTJ tendency for long-range, maybe unsettling strategic thinking, exploring extreme possibility.
Exactly. Less predicting what will happen, more exploring the conditions under which division might be overcome. Only staring into the abyss together might force us to see our shared plight.
So how did BK Sabet, the ENTJ, react to this very abstract, almost philosophical idea?
With a very practical grounding question, an incisive query, the source calls it, BK apparently asked, an earthquake, a tsunami, trying to pin the abstract idea down to something tangible.
Which makes sense for the ENTJ profile, right? That extroverted thinking meeting clear definitions, practical examples.
Precisely. It was BK engaging pragmatically, testing the boundaries by proposing specific disasters, moving it from the theoretical to the potentially real, the graspable, making the ghost solid.
And then came the author's response, the casual prophecy.
Yeah, just a quiet statement. A worldwide crisis. Like a pandemic.
Not a big dramatic moment, the source says.
No, more like the distilled crystalline endpoint of a complex internal thought process, that introverted intuition connecting the dots internally.
And the logic, according to the source.
It's chillingly coherent. If the global sickness is disunity and bad information, the cure has to be equally global and demand a unified, fact-based response. A pandemic fits structurally, ignores borders, ignores ideology, requires science and cooperation. It mirrors and counteracts the diagnosed problem.
So the pandemic concept wasn't random. It was seen as the solution that perfectly fit the shape of the problem they'd just outlined, a bitter medicine.
Exactly. The source calls this new unveiled, this breathtaking syncretic leap, connecting all these disparate things, disunity, viruses, history, survival, into one resonant, disturbing concept.
And what was BK's reaction to that?
An immediate historical echo, BK apparently asked, like the influenza pandemic a century ago.
Ah, grounding it immediately in a real devastating historical event. Smart.
Incredibly astute, yes. It tethered the abstract pandemic idea to something concrete, documented, tragic, provided a shared reference point. Suddenly, the source says, the ghost of 1918 now sat at their table. A crucial act of intellectual triangulation.
And the author's response to the 1918 comparison.
A qualified affirmation. Basically, yes, but I hope we do not lose the same percentage.
Concise, logical. Focusing on the quantifiable impact mortality rates, that sounds like the thinking preference again.
It does. But the source also highlights an undercurrent of profound latent empathy in that hope. A pragmatic acknowledgement of the potential suffering, but seen through that rational foresight. Logic tempered by the ability to foresee consequences. A stark equation.
Reflecting on that moment now, the source emphasizes the weird stillness of it all, discussing this hypothetical horror with a detachment they wouldn't have later.
Right. Unburdened as yet by the immediate, visceral, soul-searing horror. Talking about it conceptually, right there on the precipice, unknowingly tracing the shape of this monstrous, invisible shadow.
The timing is just stunning in retrospect. That idea, that seed planted just before, it really underscores the fragility of human foresight, doesn't it? The hubris of assumed certainty.
Absolutely. And then the source jumps forward to the Ides of March 2020.
When the abstract suddenly became terrifyingly real.
Exactly. Those dinner musings crystallize, coalesce into a chilling, undeniable reality. The metaphorical crisis became the concrete, corporeal form of COVID-19.
And the speed of it all, the rapid, almost cinematic escalation, must have made that earlier conversation feel incredibly eerie.
An unbearable resonance, the source says. The whispers from the dinner table became this deafening, apocalyptic roar. The world warping, shattering, everyone thrust into this terrifying news story where the old maps were useless.
And the source zeroes in on the leadership response, particularly Donald Trump's. It calls it rhetorical dissidence.
A sustained, determined effort to systematically downplay the virus, the source argues, actively constructing a comforting counter-narrative that flew in the face of emerging evidence.
It details this pattern of minimization, comparing it to the flu, promising it would magically disappear.
Yes, that consistency of minimization. Less a strategy, the source suggests, more desperate narrative management, trying to bend reality to fit a politically convenient but utterly illusory storyline, treating the virus like a PR problem.
And that specific idea of it just vanishing, the miraculous disappearance fallacy.
That was a recurring, almost talismanic motif, the source says. Promises it would just magically vanish with the seasons, warm weather, pointing to inaccurate claims, only 15 cases, close to zero, miraculously go away as examples of willfully resisting the science.
The source interprets this as putting reassurance for markets, morale, blame deflection, ahead of giving people the facts they needed.
That's the interpretation presented, a high-stakes gamble on hope. And the source's line is just brutal. The virus, however, was not listening. It became emblematic of choosing wishful thinking over hard truths. The miracle never showed up.
And tragically, that initial hypothesis about a crisis forcing unity, it went the other way.
Completely the other way, according to the source. It became a catalyst for bitter internal strife. The source points specifically to Trump pitting state against state trying to get medical supplies. A catastrophically fractured response.
Like states fighting each other for ventilators, a desperate competitive scramble.
That's the picture painted. A failure of federal leadership that actually encouraged conflict instead of coordination. A nation at war with itself while facing a common enemy.
Then amidst all this chaos, the story loops back to the dinner. May 2020, BK Sabat sends the author a birthday message.
Right, a digital note bridging the pandemic divide. You predicted the pandemic at the Mad Italian?
Wow, that must have landed heavily.
An unexpected, almost startling validation, the source calls it. A moment of shared recognition of that uncanny foresight. BK, as that ENTJ strategic thinker, apparently appreciated the pattern spotting, found the accuracy compelling.
A nod of intellectual respect, the source says, bridging the before and after.
Exactly. That shared experience suddenly gaining this profound, haunting meaning because of the crisis. A shocking validation, shadowed by tragedy.
And the author's reply.
Yep. Weird, huh?
Understated.
Very. The source suggests it masks a lot, the uncanny feeling of a thought experiment gone horribly real. The burden of being right, but having it change nothing.
Like being Cassandra, seeing the future, but being powerless to stop it. No solace, just grim awareness.
That's the feeling conveyed. Powerlessness. Seeing the storm didn't help steer anyone away, and the disconnect between that theoretical unity they discussed and the divisive reality that unfolded adds sorrow, frustration, foresight, just illuminating despair.
That simple, yep. Weird, huh? Hides a lot. A lonely and burdensome clarity, the source calls it.
Which brings us to a core reflection in the source, projecting forward to May 2025. The puzzle. The enduring, almost maddening enigma remains.
Which is?
How can intelligent people like BK, Charles, Donna from the dinner maintain what the source describes as this unwavering, almost religiously fervent adherence to a figure like Donald Trump? Especially, the source emphasizes, given what it terms a veritable litany of damning legal convictions, documented falsehoods, actions seen as undermining democratic norms. It's specifically points to findings of liability for sexual abuse, fraud judgments, actions related to inciting insurrection, presenting these as objective, judicially established fact.
And for the author, the INTJ described, this is deeply unsettling. It challenges the idea that intelligence leads to objective assessment.
Profoundly. It's an existential disorientation. The source then explores the forces it believes override reason in these situations.
Like what?
The intoxicating allure of tribal loyalty, the power of emotional resonance, the grip of deeply ingrained value systems, the seductive messianic power of a charismatic anti-establishment story. These forces, it argues, are strong enough to reframe or just push aside things that might otherwise be deal breakers.
Creating this huge, yawning, almost unbridgeable chasm of conviction. A case study in how complex belief really is.
Right. And the source suggests intelligence can even be used to build defenses for these pre-existing loyalties, constructing elaborate, almost impenetrable justifications. It's looking into the architecture of belief.
Like building mental fortresses, psychological moats, emotional drawbridges, narrative ramparts, where objective truth gets left outside.
That's the metaphor used. And the source contrasts those grim, definitive legal judgments which should be objective barriers for a logical mind.
What actually happens within supporter groups, a kind of alchemical metamorphosis.
Exactly. Where those same legal defeats are somehow reinterpreted, becoming perversely celebrated badges of honor, symbols of fighting a corrupt system, or just dismissed as politically motivated attacks, witch hunts.
So wrongdoing gets reframed as martyrdom. It shows how malleable truth can become through partisan loyalty.
That's the argument. The authority of courts, institutions is just discarded if it contradicts the preferred narrative. Truth becomes a weapon, not a reflection of reality.
And this contrast highlights those warring battle lines of the post-truth era, different groups living in separate realities.
Pretty much. One reality trying to anchor itself in evidence and law, the other described as a more seductive, emotionally resonant reality built on grievance, conspiracy, and faith in the leader.
This refusal to accept institutional findings based on political convenience, it just widens that gap in shared reality, makes it maybe irreparable.
That's the concern raised. The source also brings up what it calls the broken promises ledger.
A factual check on policy outcomes versus promises.
Yeah, looking dispassionately at things like tax cuts mostly benefiting the wealthy, trickle down, not really happening for most, capital going to buybacks, modest GDP growth, not covering debt, things where the numbers seem clear.
And for the INTJ mind, that mismatch should be a strong argument against support, logically speaking. The numbers don't lie.
But the puzzle remains. Why do intelligent people seem to overlook or rationalize these glaring, factually demonstrable discrepancies?
The source speculates they either focus elsewhere or accept explanations that aren't really based on evidence, blaming outside forces, a deep state.
It points to a fundamental divergence in how facts are even assessed. Different frameworks, different values, different narratives assigning totally different weight to the same piece of data. The enigma just gets deeper.
And a key psychological concept here is cognitive dissonance, used like a fortress.
Right. That mental discomfort when your beliefs clash with reality. The mind tries to reduce that discomfort.
Oh.
By dismissing critics, fake news, blaming enemies, focusing only on the positives, ignoring the negatives, motivated reasoning, confirmation bias, building this mental fortress for consistency, digging ideological trenches where inconvenient truths get buried.
The source also speculates specifically about BK, the ENTJ, the allure of perceived strength.
Yeah, suggesting that ENTJs, driven by that practical, world-shaping, extroverted thinking, T, can be drawn to leaders who project decisiveness, strength, a willingness to disrupt, someone who gets things done.
Even if it means bending or breaking rules.
Possibly. The source suggests that prioritizing a strategic goal like deregulation, appointing certain judges, might make ethical or procedural shortcuts seem like acceptable collateral damage.
Yeah.
The strong leader seen as a necessary tool.
And the ENTJ's intuition might see that leader as a visionary catalyst, even.
It's floated as a possibility. That tenny combo might overlook flaws if the leader seems effective in achieving a strategic vision they share. A complex bargain, maybe not even fully conscious.
And that assertiveness trait, A, they both share, comes back in here, contributing to the unwavering conviction.
Yes, creating a high threshold for changing one's mind once it's made up. Deep certainty in the integrity of one's own internal processing.
The paradox again, great for resolve, but can lock people into opposing views if their trusted processes lead them down different paths.
Another huge factor the source points to is the modern media environment. Echo chambers and information silos.
Where algorithms feed us more of what we already like and believe.
Exactly. We gravitate to sources that confirm our biases, constructing these personalized, bespoke realities that shield us from dissent.
Like hermetically sealed environments, where the same narratives just bounce around and get amplified and anything contradictory is filtered out or dismissed.
That's the description. And for Trump supporters specifically, the source portrays this as a completely self-contained, internally consistent, cognitive ecosystem.
Where everything the leader does is framed positively, critics are evil, and negative information is automatically fake news.
Right. Leading to this divergent understanding of events, facts, even science, an unquestioned consensus reality flourishing inside the bubble, making shared objective reality incredibly hard to find. Mutually incomprehensible universes, the source calls it.
The result being?
A profound hardening of partisan identities, a catastrophic deepening of that conviction chasm. The information diet reinforces the worldview, making alternatives almost impossible to comprehend psychologically. It confirms biases, fosters the besieged righteousness, locks in allegiance, the trenches get deeper.
And the casualty is the idea of a common verifiable truth.
Which leads the source to this image of a shattered mirror. This persistent divergence in perception leaves us looking at reflections in a mirror that's broken into countless pieces.
And for the INTJ, seeking logical consistency, this is a huge puzzle. How can smart people look at the same facts and reach totally incompatible conclusions?
It's an existential logical puzzle. Their trusted system of reason seems to just fail when applied to others. The shared language breaks down. Their intellectual tools lose traction on this chasm of incomprehensible conviction.
The source puts personality types like Myers-Briggs in perspective here. Useful, but limited.
Calls it a partial cipher. Helpful for understanding how people process info but not what they'll believe, doesn't dictate conclusions. The fact that even people with the same NTJ framework diverge proves this. Same tools, different materials, values, experiences, culture, information, emotions. Belief is way more complex. Type isn't the whole person.
And a key takeaway seems to be the sheer power of narrative over fact.
Hugely important, according to the source. Data and logic often lose out to a seductive, emotionally resonant narrative. We're story creatures. It's how we make meaning, find belonging.
Stories can be more powerful than stats, even for logical types.
Apparently so. If the narrative taps into identity, values, fears, the heart often hears a different drummer. When narrative dominates, the story is the reality for the believer.
Which connects to the weight of identity. Political stance isn't just opinion, it's part of who you are.
Often, yes. Fundamental to self-concept. Defines your tribe, values, reality. So changing allegiance isn't just changing your mind. It can feel like psychological self-mutilation, questioning a core part of yourself.
This identity fusion idea explains why facts bounce off sometimes. Because it's not about the facts, it's about who I am. An attack on the leader feels personal.
Exactly. It triggers primal identity defenses, makes the chasm much harder to bridge, might be touching the very soul of a nation, the source speculates.
It uses that analogy of allegiance loyalty to Trump despite flaws being like a soldier fighting for a tattered flag.
Yeah, not about a rational assessment now, but about past commitments, shared struggle, beliefs in what the flag represented. The symbol outlives the substance.
Rooted in maybe youthful ideals, camaraderie, fighting a perceived corrupt system, defending a way of life. The leader as champion for that sacred cause.
That's the analogy drawn. And circling back one last time to the mad Italian dinner, the source sees it as this stark, unyielding marker, a definitive before.
Before the world changed. But the cracks were already there. The pandemic didn't create them, just deepened them.
Precisely. The fractures, the polarization, the post-truth issues discussed at the dinner were tragically amplified by the crisis. It carved the existing fissures into a wider, maybe unbridgeable chasm. A world, it seemed, had died that night.
So the dinner becomes an archetypal symbol, not just one night, but representing that moment of transformation, the eve of metamorphosis.
And the bill, the source adds, is still being paid. The consequences are ongoing.
Which leaves us with the central, unresolved question from the source.
Can shared intelligence bridge ideological gulfs? If smarts and reason aren't enough, even among intelligent people, what in God's name, if anything, can?
It's a massive question. It really challenges simple faith in reason alone.
The source suggests intellect is necessary, but not sufficient. It often gets overruled by stronger emotional, psychological, social forces. Reason becomes the lawyer arguing for the heart's case, not the impartial judge. This whole narrative documents that divergence.
Leading to the coda, towards an epistemology of humility.
The painful realization that individual insight, even correct foresight, doesn't automatically translate into collective action.
There's this unbridgeable gap between seeing something clearly and getting the collective ship to turn.
Seems so. One mind can't easily overcome the inertia of narratives, biases. An idea's power depends on how it's received in a hostile ecosystem. The marketplace of ideas isn't level.
So being right shouldn't lead to arrogance, but humility. Knowing your vision might not be enough.
That's the argument. Seeing from the watchtower doesn't help if people below won't look up, or if dogma obscures the view. The intellect is a small boat in a huge, stormy sea of consciousness.
This leads to thinking about the elusive nature of truth today. With engineered narratives, weaponized info, algorithms.
Right. Does objective truth even stand a chance? The source wonders if it flickers like a candle in a gale of manufactured consensus and echo chambers. Has truth just become another commodity to be traded?
making it incredibly hard to find a shared factual baseline when groups live in separate info bubbles with their own facts, authorities, demons.
Meaningful dialogue, problem solving become almost impossible. Truth becomes malleable, strategic, used to reinforce identity, mobilize action, push agendas. Reality correspondence is secondary to its utility. The map replaces the territory and declares war on it.
A fundamental threat to democracy, civil society. If you can't agree on what's real, how do we face anything together? It's a treacherous labyrinth.
And looking beyond personality types, the source stresses again that frameworks like MBTI are useful but limited. Understanding conviction requires digging deeper.
Into what?
The tapestry woven from deeply held, often unexamined, values, formative life experiences, cultural influences, hidden cognitive biases. These shape the lens through which we see everything.
Even with shared logic, different core values, liberty versus security, tradition versus progress, lead down different paths, and experiences write themselves into our beliefs.
Absolutely. To really understand why someone believes something, the source says you need to explore their biography, culture, emotional needs, anxieties, biases. Human conviction is more complex than any framework. The heart and mind are vast, uncharted.
The source also revisits the pandemic's unlearned lesson. COVID showed our deep interconnectedness, right? Fate of one equals fate of all.
It objectively did. It demanded shared info, transparency, coordinated science-based action. It required trust and prioritizing the common good.
But failure to learn, that lesson got lost.
Often overshadowed, subverted by polarization, the source argues. We retreated into trenches. The pandemic became political territory. Calls for solidarity were drowned out by partisanship, scapegoating, addictive narratives. We learned nothing or the wrong things.
A testament to the enduring power of division, tribalism, self-interest winning out, leaving doubt about handling future crises.
That's the bleak assessment. But despite that, there's still this metamorphic call for dialogue.
A persistent push for empathetic understanding, because giving up means surrendering to disintegration.
Exactly. And the hope lies in finding new ways, new languages to navigate opposing beliefs, not about winning, but a collaborative quest to understand the hidden landscapes, motivations, fears, hopes on the other side.
Approaching the other not as an enemy, but a fellow traveler, whose map might hold some truths.
And that requires humility, knowing our own limits. Curiosity, asking why, not just what. Acknowledging shared humanity, even in disagreement. Seeing the person behind the belief. Fostering conversations about exploring, not winning.
Which leads to the final musing on the elaborate dance of human consciousness. Our capacity for brilliance versus our capacity for delusion.
That constant tension. Knowing versus feeling certain. Truth versus comforting belief. Dancing across divides, we build ourselves. Architects of enlightenment. Jailers of our own minds.
And the analog for the future is navigating this post-truth fog.
This miasma obscuring reality demands an internal compass, critical thinking, T, plus intuition, N, piercing illusions, deconstructing narratives.
Cognitive tools aren't enough. We also need empathetic inquiry, understanding the why behind beliefs, exploring those emotional, experiential landscapes.
That's the conclusion. The path forward requires cultivating both critical minds and open, compassionate hearts. Skepticism married to understanding, striving for common ground when reality itself feels shaky. In that striving, that humility and empathy, lies hope.
So after all that deep, complex material, what does it mean for you listening right now?
Well, it means understanding these dynamics, how minds work differently, the incredible power of stories, how identity shapes belief, the trap of echo chambers. It isn't just theoretical.
No, it's absolutely crucial for navigating the world we actually live in. Mm. Recognizing these forces in ourselves just as much as in others, that feels like the essential first step. Maybe the only way to find better paths forward.
And perhaps the most provocative question the source leaves hanging, that central puzzle.
If intelligence alone can't bridge these huge ideological divides, then what on earth can?
Consider the possibility the source raises. Maybe the way forward isn't just about thinking harder. Maybe it's more about radical humility, admitting we don't have all the answers, and a real willingness to engage with empathy, even across the widest, scariest divides.
What does it really mean to seek understanding when the very idea of objective truth feels like it's up for grabs? Something to definitely keep thinking about.